I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Carl Honoré joins me now. The acclaimed best-selling author has just published a new book, Boulder, Making the Most of Our Longer Lives. In the book, Mr. Honoré travels the world meeting unique people who redefine aging. He looks at various trends as well as different attitudes on working past the age of 65, health, and death. We seem unwilling to address the natural course of dying, that it precludes us from living better, fuller lives. Carl Honoré is the world's leading advocate of the slow movement. His book, In Praise of Slow, Challenging the Cult of Speed, was an international sensation. His other books include Under Pressure and The Slow Fix. Visit carlhonoré.com and the Twitter handle at Carl Honoré for more. This new book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Plata Online program, Carl Honoré. Mr. Honoré, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
So one doesn't realize, I mean, until I read your book, that just how much better life expectancy is now versus, say, 100 years ago. I mean, it's doubled or in some cases more, right?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are startling, really. I mean, it's for most of human history, life expectancy was bumping around, before the modern era anyway, around 30,
which is
incredibly low. Whereas nowadays in Canada, you're looking into the 80s for both men and women. I mean, of course, you've got to parse those figures a little because it was very low in the past. A big reason for that was that many people died in early childhood.
Mm.
So that kind of skewed the figures a bit. So, of course, if you got past early childhood and managed to survive into adolescence and beyond, you stood a much better chance than it sounds to live a longer life. But nothing compared to what's going on now. We are in the middle of a longevity revolution.
Yeah, and but what hasn't changed, and I think this is the problem that you pose in the book and address, are our attitudes towards aging. I mean, we still have all of these ageist ideas in our heads, don't we?
We do, and I would argue that they've become much worse and more acute in the late 20th century with the culture quake in the 60s, and we really, in that point in our history, created a cult of youth. So we put the idea of being young on a pedestal, and the flip side of that, of course, is that growing older becomes the bad thing, right? It becomes a game of shame, decline, guilt, decrepitude, depression. I mean, it's just, we have such a chamber of horrors view of growing older, and it depends. Some people draw the line in different places, but often nowadays it's, you know, from the age of 30 or whatever, 35 or sometimes 40, people just feel like it's an endless downhill spiral in every way, and everything is going to get worse. And the truth, of course, is that that's untrue, right? There's a whole other story, a good news story to tell about aging. The problem is that our attitudes have not kept pace with this demographic bounty that is spreading out before us in the form of the longevity revolution.
Yeah, even retirement. I mean, we've grown up thinking that 65 was it, but that's certainly not it for a lot of people. So I mean, I guess the best question to ask you is what is old? Like, but that's the other interesting thing about the book is that it's a very fluid sort of definition that one could come up with, right?
Very. And in fact, I had to do a lot of dancing with the language and playing around with trying to find the right words, because a big part of what is driving and underpinning the ageist culture is the language we use, right? It's woven into our vernacular.
A
we
number,
talk about senior
yeah.
moments and then, you know, all this stuff, and it just kind of pushes us towards this idea that aging is always a bad thing. But we're at a point now where we have so much to offer, and yet we're still prisoners of the old way of thinking and the old way of speaking. And the words, so many of the words that are associated with growing older are toxic. You know, they are freighted with bad vibes. So the word old, I mean, you know, Dame Judi Dench in England, where I live, the famous actress, has outlawed, banned the word old altogether in her house, right? Because she just feels she just wants with the associations, the cargo of grimness that it carries is so heavy that people just don't want to be involved with it. So in fact, in the book, I don't actually really talk about, I don't use that word that much, and I don't know, there's something about it that feels like the very last station on the train line somehow.
Yeah.
Old. I prefer older, which feels more open-ended, more fluid, more bespoke and personal. Each person is a different point on that life path, and sometimes you're older than you were, you know, you're always older than you were before, and you're going to be older ahead. And rather than trying to pin people down and say, put them in boxes, because that's really what I'm trying to do with this book, and I think that's what's happening in the culture now. We're trying to break out of this straitjacket where the age boxes us in, right? Where we feel defined and constrained by the number in a way that makes no sense in the world we live in.
Now, you felt prey to this yourself as you opened the book. You said that, mm-hmm. you know, as you were turning 50, a lot of these thoughts were coming across in your head. And so I'm wondering, after having gone through that and now written this book, how has your own thinking changed, say, about being more than 50?
For me, it's a night and day shift. There's a very clear before and after. I have to come out as a card-carrying ageist, you know, in my before. I had such a dim, downbeat view of growing older. I didn't even want to think about it, right? I just pushed it to one side and just tried to carry on doing what I was doing without even thinking about what it meant to be, you know, hitting 40 and then 45 and, yeah. and so on. Whereas now, having done the research and spent a couple of years traveling around and thinking and researching this around the world, my attitudes are now transformed. You know, I just don't. I see now that aging is much more nuanced, complex, tangled, but richer than this Chamber of Horrors view. Of course, there are things that change as we grow older that are unwelcome, and we're not going to like them. But there are many things that stay the same. And the thing that really blew me away through my research is that there are actually many things that get better. Mm. And so I'm now looking forward, in a way, to the next, you know, whatever years, however many years are left to me, rather than either ignoring it, putting it, like nullifying it, putting it out of my mind, or dreading it. That shame, guilt, fear, and dread that attaches to the very act of growing older for so many of us, I think for me, has just evaporated. And that's been the great take-home and yeah. takeaway for the book, for me personally.
You mentioned traveling for this book, and you get to a number of places, and you talk to some fascinating, interesting people. One place you went to, I guess it was in Thailand. Was it a noodle factory?
It was a noodle factory, yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's on the outskirts of Bangkok, and it's famous for carrying on with its staff, you know, until they cannot work anymore, right? So you've got people there who are working in their 70s and 80s. And this is something, it was a rule established by the owner way back, you know, so decades. It's not a new uh-huh. thing. And it's just quite an uplifting experience to go to a place like that and see people putting in a shift. And we're not talking about, you know, on the face of it, this could be the kind of work that people would say, well, no, I don't really want to do this. But they love coming to work. And it's, I mean, of course, it's a nice factory. It's a sort of family atmosphere. But it's a reminder that, you know, that keeping your oar in, you know, keeping active, keeping engaged, having some kind of purpose, or what the Japanese call ikigai, that meaning or that purpose in your life that gets you out of bed in the morning, that's so, so important. And to lock ourselves into the old traditional life path of learning in youth, working in middle age, you know, mm. those years, and then stopping at 62 or 65 and just playing golf and bingo for the rest of the next maybe 30 years, right?
Yeah.
Just doesn't, I think, make sense. It doesn't really hold water for most people nowadays, and that's why you're starting to see the tectonic plates shifting and people looking to carry on. They don't want to do an 80-hour week maybe in their late 60s, but they might want to do an 8-hour week or 18-hour yeah. or have two or three little portfolio bits and pieces that they carry on doing. And it was to go out to somewhere like Thailand, where you don't think of it as being on the cutting edge of social reform or, you know, culture quakes, yeah. to see that in action was pretty, gave me a fill-up.
And so it's great for these older people to be able to be useful and it's good for their health, I would assume, to be active and working. What's it like for some of the younger people, though, to be working with people that are older? I mean, did you find in that particular firm it, say, beneficial for everybody, even the people that own the company, say?
Very much so. And that was one of the things that I found most lovely in the research and the discoveries that I made along the way, is this, the magic and the music that happens when you mix up the generations, which, of course, is something that we've done through all cultures and across all of human history. The different age groups mixed together, whether it was in the home or in the fields or the market or whatever. Whereas in the modern era, we've walled ourselves off in silos, so you have very little contact, really, with people of different ages. And something is lost there, you know, the transfer of knowledge, you know, both up and down the age chain,
yeah.
The kind of experience. And also, you're much more likely to be ageist and to have a really bad view of aging if you don't know any older people, right?
Right.
Because that's in that ignorance blossoms and blooms all of those deep, dark thoughts that we have about growing older. But when you find yourself, whether in the workplace or in your home and neighborhood, surrounded by people of different ages, you realize that there's so many different ways to grow older, and that a lot of it is going to be pretty good. And so, certainly coming back to what you're saying there about the factory, that people loved it. I mean, I spoke to the young and the old there, and everybody loved that mix, and it was very good for. I mean, even in the corporate world in the West, you hear a lot of talk, of course, nowadays about diversity, diverse yeah. teams, the power of diverse teams, and having people of different ages boosts productivity, creativity, collaboration, cooperation, so many things, right? And also, a lot of the research shows conclusively that work performance in the modern workplace, where most of it is now social and knowledge-based, gets better as we get older, yeah, right? Yeah. It doesn't get worse, right? So this idea that somehow productivity, creativity for the young is weapons-grade nonsense.
Yeah, yeah. And it doesn't apply to work as well. I mean, even in your friendships and your family relations, mixing across the generations is beneficial. Some of my closest friends are much older than I am, and I, of course, have friends that are my age. But I can't tell you just how you know, I mean, even selfishly, I mean, when you talk to someone older, you can even avoid some of the mistakes that they made, right?
Exactly, right. I mean, people often talk about wisdom and so on, and I don't think necessarily everybody becomes wise as they grow older.
Right.
I mean, we only need to look at what's happening to the current occupant of the White House, right? But clearly, what does happen is people garner experience. They have stories to tell, and that's how we make sense of the world is through narrative, it's through stories, and through the lens of other people's experience and their stories. And of course, you know, when you find yourself talking to older people, you know, whether you're 20 and talking to somebody in their 30s, or whether you're late 30s talking to a 50-something or 50-something, you know, you're going to learn things. And,
yeah.
and it is a two-way street, of course, because there's a kind of renewal of those new ideas and new ways of thinking that maybe younger people are more likely to glom onto. Those things get passed up to
yeah.
people in later life, and it just creates a richer brew in the culture and the society for everyone to thrive more.
One of the problems to all of this, though, that as I read your book, is and you talk about this, is how we view death. And I guess because we're so afraid of it, we don't know how to talk about it, and so we just don't. And you suggest that we need to approach death differently. I mean,
I
think the fear of death really precludes us from leading the fuller lives that we'd like, right?
Exactly. And I think actually the fear of death, the fear of mortality, also drives ageism because the death, which nobody wants to experience, kind of gives aging a bad name because,
yeah,
of course,
yeah.
aging is bringing you closer to the Grim Reaper and the final finish line. But the solution to that is not to deny or to ignore or never think about death. Cultures around the world throughout history, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism, all have some form of death meditation or bring death into the conversation. Why not to become some kind of morbid, you know, cellar dwelling, person who, but on the contrary, because when you think about death, what that tells you or brings into sharp focus for you is that life is finite. You do have an end. There's a book ended, right? There's a start and a finish. And that has the effect of causing you to focus more and get more from the here and now, right? To be more in the moment, to think, well, okay, I'm going to make the most of what I've got,
yeah.
Rather than kind of fritter it away or multitask it away and so on. So, you know, one of the things I did in the book, you've seen, is I downloaded an app called We Croak, right? Which sends you regular reminders that you're going to die. And it sounds ludicrous and morbid, but actually I find it quite helpful in a sense. You know, sometimes if I'm freaking out about something or not seeing the big picture, just that little moment of thinking, yeah, you know what, my time here is finite. I'm really just a grain of sand on a very big beach, and rather than worrying about, you know, X, Y, I'm just going to focus on enjoying and getting the most out of whatever it is I'm doing now. So I think we have lost the art of dying well in the modern world. We've turned it into a medicalized thing. It's kind of, you know, it's not around us, and when we see it, it's sort of hyper cartoonized in Tarantino films or video games. We just kind of lost that deep human bond with the act of dying, because that's a part of every life, right? And to bring it back, I think, is one of the ways that we change our approach to aging. We change our feelings about aging. We get better at aging, I think, if we get better at dying.
And another great lesson in the book is that because we don't let go of stuff, and then I'm talking about emotional baggage as well as literal baggage with all the stuff that we have in our homes. That's a very useful experience, isn't it? To say, I mean, let people go sometimes, right?
It is, and it sounds callous and it sounds cold, but yeah. It's what the world is. You cannot have it all, right? You simply cannot, and I think that's one of the big benefits of growing older is that you streamline. Mm-hmm. You get more comfortable in your own skin. You don't worry so much about what other people think, and you begin to look a little bit more inside and say, well, what really lights me up? You know, what puts fire in my belly? What am I going to look back on my deathbed and say, yeah, I'm glad I did that? And I think once you get that confidence and that clarity as you move up through your years, you start to drop stuff. You say, okay, this friendship isn't working for me anymore. I'm just going to let it go. Or this job doesn't fire me up. I'm just going to move on to something different. And that is so liberating. I think it points to another one of those benefits of later life is the kind of lightness that comes. You know, it's almost like we do a kind of Marie Kondo on ourselves, right? We say, this thing isn't sparking joy, it's out, it's gone,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You focus on the stuff that really means something to us. It's going to be there for a purpose and spark that joy. And I think that's for me, I notice that now, and I'm 51. I'm very different in that way from where I was in my 30s, where I felt like I had to do everything and I had to say yes to everybody. And I was, you don't have to. And there's a wonderful quote. I have another book from Ann Landers, which I think really nails this, where she says something. Famous agony aunt said once that at 20, we worry about what other people think about us. At 40, we stop worrying about what other people think of us. But at 60, we realize they were never thinking about us at all. There's something very liberating about that. That you just, because we become prisoners of other people's expectations and prejudices and so on. And if we can take that yoke off our back, get that big rucksack of boulders and heavy weight off, everything becomes lighter and happier. Yeah. And maybe that may partly explain the weird phenomenon that is the U-shaped happiness curve, which is that happiness tends to start pretty high in youth, bottom out in middle age, and then go up again. So that in Canada, for instance, the age cohort that reports the highest levels of happiness and life satisfaction is the over 60s, right? You know, which again gives the lie to that old ageist myth that growing older is sad, old, grumpy, cantankerous people, you know. That's not true. Not true.
Now, the brain exercises, because you talk about that in the book, especially, you know, we want to keep ourselves nimble, especially in our heads. Crosswords, Sudoku, those kind of things, do they actually work in terms of as we get older?
Anything you do is helpful. But what they've found is that to get the real payoff cognitively, crossword Sudoku is not really enough. You need to be pushing yourself hard, so hard in learning new things, exposing yourself to novelty, that it becomes almost uncomfortable, and then you push through that pain barrier a little bit, come out the other side. That's when you start to get the kind of cognitive rewiring, the changing the brain. That's when you really get the big payoff. And I call it in the book, I call it doing your cognitive burpees, in a sense. Because it's that idea of doing something nobody likes doing burpees, right? They really hurt. And you start doing, you got to do 10, and by 3, you're thinking, oh, gee, my. But yeah, push on through. And that's when you get the real payoff. And that's when you keep your, and how you keep your brain fighting fit and sharp, you know, all the way up, right? You know, you look at Nancy Pelosi, right? Or David Attenborough. I mean, these people are just luminous, right? They're just smashing it.
Yeah.
And they're the kind of people who will, especially David Attenborough, is always looking for new things. And it's a reminder that the old saying that you can't teach an old dog new tricks isn't even true of dogs, right?
Right.
You know, if people can carry on learning, and not only can they carry on learning, it should be an imperative that we carry on learning, that we carry on trying to take on new stuff and ignore that voice that says, I can't learn Spanish. I'm 50.
Yeah.
You can, right? Roll up your sleeves and get stuck in. And it'll be a lot of fun learning Spanish, but also it'll be very, very good for your brain.
Yeah. You talk at the end of the book, and I found this fascinating, and I'm trying to work through it in my own head. You talk about getting older and altruism, because we think that we're going to wait. And like, I'm 36, and I think, I'll do all my charity work once I'm retired, once I've amassed my meager fortune, whatever that might be. But you say that that's not a good sort of attitude, is it?
No. I mean, I think two things I would say to that. One is that we ought to be encouraging and making space for and allowances for people to get out there and give back at every age, right? We should be encouraging it in teenage years through 20s and so on.
Right.
Of course, it can be harder, especially to get into you know, that time when you're also you're working and maybe you've got small children. You know, but I think as one of those tectonic changes, seismic shifts we need to make in our society, we need to put caring and volunteering and giving back, or whatever you want to call it, charity work, at the core rather than on the periphery of our lives. So that's one sort of macro meta point I would make. But if tying it back to aging, one of the things that I found most fascinating in the research is that something seems to happen to us, whatever, and this is across all cultures and income groups and, you know, career or whatever it is, that as we age, especially as we get sort of into 40 and beyond, we seem to develop this stronger urge to be altruistic, right? To give back, to make some kind of, leave some kind of legacy, to leave the world a better place than we found it. And that partly explains why, you know, in later life, people, you know, that's where you see all the volunteering going on and stuff. But again, I wouldn't want that to be an argument for saying, put it all off till later life. Let's have it all the way through. But again, as a sort of sunny take on this, I would say that's another thing to look forward to as you grow up through your 20s and 30s, is actually maybe you wouldn't have to push yourself to do the caring. You're actually going to feel it in your gut. It's going to be something that you're just gravitating towards naturally, and you're going to become less solipsistic, less selfish, less tied up in your own stuff, and more willing to go out there into the world and try and make it a little bit better than it was when you entered it.
Do you find through your work, through this book, this is already a hit, and then your previous books, they've all done very well. Do you think you've, in terms of writing them, have done a service yourself? I mean, do you feel that you're helping others in terms of how they look at their own lives?
I do feel that, and I certainly hope that that's the case. I mean, I got into writing. I was first a journalist, and I got into it to save the world. I've always had, I think, a bit of a save the world complex, and I got into journalism. I'd been in Brazil as part of Canada World Youth, and I'd sort of seen the deprivation and the poverty, and I thought, well, the way to deal with this is to write about it, to bring it to people's attention and change things that way. So that my first, you know, 10, 11 years of my working career was devoted to that, and then I got into books, and in a sense, I feel like I've always been doing the same thing with my books, my first three books, which are all about the benefits of slowing down and taking on this faster is better culture. I guess what I was trying to do there was take down the cult of speed and to show that, you know, faster isn't always better. And now with Boulder, I'm taking on the cult of youth. So I suppose I'm always in one way or another trying to save the world, but I don't want to sound like I'm Mother Teresa, right? I'm trying to save myself as well, because I wrote my earlier books because I was just a roadrunner. You know, every moment of my day had become a race against the clock. I needed to reconnect with my inner tortoise, right? So I set out to write books about it. And in a sense, as I'm getting a bit of perspective on Boulder and seeing it out in the world, I'm realizing that was kind of why, obviously, really why I wrote Boulder as well. I wrote it for myself, too, you know, to not feel ashamed of playing in a ball hockey tournament in my late 40s or early 50s. You know, why should you? You know, I can play, I enjoy it, and that should be the end of the discussion. The number in that instance shouldn't matter. The number segues into something else I wanted to say, which is that people often trot out this phrase nowadays, you know, age is just a number. And it sounds, you know, light and fluid and great, but I don't use that phrase because I think that age, the number does matter, right? Yeah. I mean, nobody is the same at 50 as they were at 30. And like Muhammad Ali said, anyone who's the same at 50 who is at 30 has wasted 20 years of their life. We do change. We do change, and it's important to acknowledge that and to embrace it and to make sense of it and to try and get the most out of that change. What I think is changing now, the real shift in our culture, is that I think in the past, certainly with the cult of youth, that the number had come, it had acquired a terrible power over us. It had become something that defined and constrained us and put us into a box or a drawer or a cubbyhole, so that you hear that number and think, oh, no, I'm this age, therefore, da-da-da-da-da. So I'm 40, I can't launch a startup, or I'm 50, I can't learn Spanish, or I'm 60, I can't take up kite surfing, or I'm 70, I can't fall in love again, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas that's where I think the change is coming now. We're moving away from being so tightly and stultifyingly defined by the number, the chronological age, to be something much more fluid. So we move, I think what we're moving into is a world now where we'll move through our lives and just define, each person will define what each age means for them. Their 30 will be something different for you as it is for me, or 50, you know, but it'll be on my terms or your terms rather than this grim idea that at 40, oh, no, you can't do that. You know, all of that stuff that pulls us back and closes doors instead of opening them. And another example of how this needle is moving, right? I do think that the goalposts are shifting and the tectonic plates are changing, is that Netflix and Amazon no longer track their users by age. They track them by taste.
Yeah.
And I think that shows where we're going now. We're going to create a world, we're already creating it, I think, where what matters is not how old you are, but what you watch on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
Or what books you read, or what food you cook for the people you love, or the places you love to travel, the sports you play. That's what is going to define people rather than their birth date. And that is such, to me, such a liberating an uplifting message. I'm so glad I wrote this book.
Yeah.
I wish I'd written it 20 years ago. I could have saved myself two decades of dread and shame about my own aging, but better late than never, right?
Well, I'm turning 37 shortly, and so I'm looking forward to the next 15 years, having now read your book and talked to you. I mean, you've given us a great roadmap, if you will, in terms of how to look at this,
They're going to be great. I mean, that's one thing to take away from this, I think, is that the big challenge we're all facing now is not aging, it's ageism. That is the real challenge. And if you think that aging is going to be bad, then there's a very, very good chance it will, because we know from all the research and studies that ageism, that toxic view of growing older, if you hold a bad view of getting older, you are going to age badly.
Yeah.
That's just, you're going to age more quickly, you're going to probably live less while you're going to... It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if we flip that round and say, okay, I accept that there are things I'm not going to like about growing older, but at the same time, I'm going to try and swivel my sights and focus on the other side of that equation, which is that many things are going to stay the same, and other things are actually going to get better. And that's where I'm going to try and put most of the eggs in my basket. I'm going to try and put most of my attention there. And that's going to revolutionize, I think, how we all age.
It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Carl. Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Thank you. Thanks. I've enjoyed it.
The book is called Bolder, Making the Most of Our Longer Lives. It's published by Knopf. Carl Honoré joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.